Hi there, I'm James Littwell. I'm your host here on Authors on the Air, a global radio network. And it's my pleasure to sit down and chat today with Terrence McCauley. And you're going to get to know Terrence here because you're gonna want to. He's what I call the Swiss Army knife of the author community. He writes everything and writes it really well. That's the part that is confusing for most folks. Terrence is an award-winning, best-selling author of thrillers, crime fiction, and westerns. His latest novella that we'll be talking about today is Chicago 63. It's available everywhere from Silverback Publishing, and his website is terrencemccauley.com. So welcome, Terrence. It's good to see you.
It's great seeing you, pal, as always.
Yeah. Hey, congratulations on this new book. I mean, it's Chicago 63, really cool cover, but the story itself was it kind of blew my socks off. I didn't know a lot of the background here, but it was actually inspired by real events that you uncovered. And why don't we start with that and kind of tell us, you know, in this era of 63 post Bay of Pigs invasion, and, you know, how did this story come together and what can folks expect to see in Chicago 63?
Sure. Well, the big thing for me with this story was that it all happened actually as I wrote it. I mean, it is a novella, so it's not a nonfiction piece. So I took events of an investigation that did actually happen in early November, late October of 1963, about an actual visit that President Kennedy was going to make to Chicago. He was running for re-election, and he was going to attend the Army Air Force game, in Soldier Field. So he was going to land at O'Hare, drive through the city, take a slow 90-degree turn off the highway onto a local road, past warehouses, and go on his way to the football game. Unfortunately, that has a lot of resemblance to what was happening later that month in Dallas. And when I saw that detail, I said, God, that is too creepy to be a coincidence. That is amazing. And I also heard over the years a lot about first plot to assassinate Kennedy at other places. One of them was Miami. One of them was Tampa. Another one was possibly Nashville. But the Chicago plot was the only one that had some people who had been brought into custody over the possible assassination attempt. There were four Cubans who were seen in a rooming house along the parade route who had scoped rifles. Only two of them had been apprehended, two disappeared and were never seen again. The records of those people, the two Cubans who were arrested by the Secret Service and questioned, those records are gone. We don't know who they are, but we do know they had been arrested. The other one was Arthur Valley, who was a loner, a Marine, sharpshooter, all sounds familiar, a little bit of an oddball who didn't fit in anywhere, did a lot of odd jobs, and was also involved in the Cuban anti-Castro camps that were spread all throughout the United States and Central America. Valley was definitely linked to one that was in Long Island, New York. And so it was after he left Long Island, returned to his native Chicago, where I believe he was involved in the plot, because the day Kennedy was supposed to be in Chicago, he was pulled over by two very interesting Chicago detectives who had been following him. And they found a trunk full of ammunition in his car, but no rifle. Wow. So all of these things, the four Cubans that were arrested on the were staying along the parade route, Valley, I pulled all of that together and I created the plot that culminates in Chicago 63. The one thing about the whole investigation that got me was that today we have this idea of the hyper-prepared federal government. They have plans and plans on top of plans. They have an army of people they could throw at any problem. That's not exactly true today, and it certainly wasn't true back in 1963. The one thing that fascinated me was that the Secret Service office in Chicago was only about eight people. Wow. And they relied on other agencies to help them investigate threats to the president and also protect him while he was anywhere in the United States. One of those groups was the Chicago Police Department. The other one was the FBI. So the real life investigation only involved three or four people. But in my book, I make Abraham Bolden the protagonist. And Abraham Bolden is a hero in this story for a different reason in real life.
Let's really talk about one of the things I've always appreciated about your books are your characters, the way you really bring them to life. I mean, they're not just set pieces. I mean, you can kind of get into their lives. And Abraham Golden and Homer Echevarria, the two kind of counterpoint characters in the book, really stand out. And after I read the author's notes, you know, there's a real story behind your main protagonist, Abraham Golden. So talk about that, if you would.
Sure. Yeah. In reality, in the book, I call him Golden because he is different from the real life person of Abraham Bolden. Abraham Bolden was the first African-American Secret Service agent who was ever assigned a protection detail. And that was at the request of President Kennedy. And so he wanted him to be the first black man who ever protected him while he was in office. And Kennedy often called him the Jackie Robinson of the Secret Service, something Bolden, to this day, I believe he's still alive, holds justifiably so as a great honor. In reality, I don't get into it in the book. He was also one of the best counterfeit agents they had in the service. He was, mm-hmm. That was his bread and butter. That's what he was known for. In the book, I have him do all of these investigations into this plot that the Secret Service is examining all of the hate groups who were active in Chicago during the president's visit. That kind of investigation happened. Bolden wasn't a part of it. In my book, he is. But in reality, we only know about the plot because later, after it happened, Bolden tried to tell the Warren Commission about this plot. He put together various communications, radio communications, reports, etc., that he found, and he tried to present that to the Warren Commission as evidence that it wasn't just one lone nut in Dallas, that this had been done before. And unfortunately, they didn't want to hear it because, as you can imagine, at the time, sentiment was high. People were worrying about us being pulled into a war with Russia or possibly against Cuba if they ever thought that they had anything to do with an attempted assassination on our president. And so they said, no, there was no plot. That's it. Bolden also wound up a few years later getting ensnared in a bribery scandal and spent several years in federal prison. He was recently, his sentence was commuted and he was pardoned by President Biden in 2022. But that tells you how long that kind of injustice went on for. And for me, I thought his real life heroism should make him the protagonist and the hero in this particular book.
No, I think you did a fantastic job, you know, bringing that character to life, because you really got the sense that, you know, he was up against multiple obstacles, you know, the culture at the time, the organization, corruption in Chicago, and it all kind of tied together with, you know, really a perfect sea of torment that was going to lead to this potential assassination. You have a way of just laying out, you know, historical fiction like this story and just pulling the reader into a specific time and place, and it feels authentic. How did you manage to do that? I mean, that's a skill set there that not everybody can pull off.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I've learned in reading an awful lot of this kind of genre, the thriller genre, is that books often die because they get too complex. They get bogged down in technology. They get bogged mm-hmm. down in procedure. They get bogged down in acronyms. And sometimes they also get bogged down because they have too many characters and the audience will lose focus, if you will. A perfect example of that is the justified popularity that Shogun is experiencing right now. That's a book that came out a long time ago from James Clavell about the first English who were in Japan way back when. They have re-released Shogun, but as two books, because they figured that Shogun itself would be too big for modern audiences to want to read through. So maybe the literature hasn't changed. I mean, I hope they haven't changed the book at all, but they had to break it up because it was so big that people, they didn't think modern audiences would read it. And I think for better or for worse, audience appetites change from generation to generation. So for something like this, and in all of my historical work, I try to thread in the historical aspects of it as part of the scenery and as part of the setting, not as a what I would call a jump cut or a deposit of information, an info dump, if you will. Right. Like we saw in books like The Da Vinci Code. Great book, mega bestseller, I mean, and I get it. But you could see as you were reading through that, there were these huge exposition dumps of information about art and technique and everything that were plopped right down in the middle of dialogue. And I, for me, it just was an awful lot for me to get through, and I could see what it was. So I don't want to ever be able to lose the audience based on a decision like that. I want to be able to thread it all in. So you get history, you get character aspects, the plot absolutely has to move along, but not get in the way of the overall momentum of the story. That's what I try to do when I write history.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, I think you pulled it off really masterfully in Chicago 63.
Well, thank you,
Paul. Yeah, my pleasure. Now, there's and congratulations on a new book, a book deal that's related to this that kind of continues that vein of story. Can you talk a little bit about that and what we might
see in coming up? I am so glad to be able to say that I am going to be working with your publisher, Level Best Books. You were the one who actually gave me the idea to give them a chance and submit to them. You and Pam Stack both spoke very highly of them. And Pam is, as we know, wonderful. She knows everything about this business. And so I submitted the original story that this came from, Dallas 63, to them. Dallas 63 is a trilogy I plan to tell about the Kennedy assassination, but only from a Dallas detective's point of view. So it's very much going to be a crime novel. And like I was just saying earlier, some of those thrillers that we all love are sprawling epics. If you take, for example, James Ellroy's American Tabloid trilogy, they get involved in the Cubans going to Cuba, going to different places, Jimmy Hoffa, other members of the mob, the federal government. And I think all of them may have played a role in this, but for today's audiences, I don't know if they're going to go along with a lot of that kind of information, if they're going to be willing to follow a story that has that many tendrils to it. So for me, I wanted to tell it in what I know best, telling a crime story, telling it in a way that you have interesting characters that are involved in historically accurate events, and putting my own spin on it so it's much easier to understand. So Level Best Books liked that idea. They liked my approach. They liked the different characters I'm going to have in it. And they particularly liked this book because this spawns right out of Dallas 63. I had written this as part of that book, but then I said, you know, I love this character so much, Abraham Golden, but he disappears after a third of the book because obviously the plot runs its course. And I said, I've written so much great about him. I love the character. I don't want him to just disappear, but if I keep him around, it's going to seem like I'm giving him stuff to do. And he deserves better than that. So that's why I pulled him out, and in working with my buddies over at Silverback Publishing, we decided to create a novel dedicated just to him. And we're very pleased with the results.
Yeah, and you should be. I think it's really, really well done. And yeah, I'm looking forward to Dallas 63. And I don't know if you had a chance to, when we were at VoucherCon in Dallas, to kind of go through the museum there and see that 90-degree corner. And it was surprisingly how close things really were. And then the grassy knoll right next door. Do you have any favorite conspiracy theory that you think really happened there at that location.
Right. I think the whole thing of people thinking that it was a bunch of people in a smoke-filled room, rubbing their hands and plotting and coming up with a grand idea of things, I don't think that was necessarily the case. Based on a lot of the research I've done on the case, I think it was four or five committed individuals who had the motive, means, and opportunity to do it. I don't think it was a full government approach. I think the cover-up into the assassination and what happened was because they didn't want it to look like it was a broader conspiracy, because they were afraid people would demand we go to war with whoever they thought was responsible for it at the time. So it was cleaner just to make it Oswald, that's it, lone nut, close it and get it off the books. And even people on the Warren Commission themselves said people will forget about it in a year. They'll never read the report. But the problem is people have done research into it, unlike a lot of other conspiracy theories, more questions just keep popping up about the tertiary people who were involved. The people who were in Oswald's life, for example, all related to intelligence at some point. It's tough to just shrug that off and say, oh, they didn't need to be there. These were people that didn't interact normally, but they were some very important people who interacted with Oswald. And they wouldn't necessarily have to if the guy didn't serve a purpose.
Right.
And he wasn't just a charity case. He served a purpose. And I think it was I think it was anti-segregationists. I think it was the extreme right who wanted revolution in the country who set him up for the fall, because he made a convenient fall guy.
Yeah. No, I think you make some good points there. Now, you've written historical thrillers. You wrote the espionage series with the University series, your Westerns, and now this kind of true crime linked thriller. And you switch back and forth really effectively. How do you make that switch, either in your head or, you know, on the page, when you're widely different kind of field you're playing on? How do you do that?
Right. Well, I love a challenge and I never want to get stale. I never want to mail in a book, and I never have. I love changing up the genre. I love changing up the setting and the time period because it keeps me fresh. And I know at the heart, no matter when a story is set, whether it's the Old West, Victorian England, modern day, or 1963 Chicago or Dallas, it all has to have a good story at its heart. And we can let the trappings fool us, but ultimately the story has to be relatable, the audience has to believe it, and the audience has to be invested in it somehow. So I find that if I'm able to do that, no matter where I set my stories, I have to, I'm ahead of the game. Now, it's not as simple as taking one of my 1930s books, for example, putting a cowboy hat on a hitman and making him the sheriff. That doesn't work. And there are people who have tried to do that, and they have failed miserably because it's not that easy. Every era you write about has certain quirks to it, certain facts. So when I was writing my Westerns, for example, I had to know the different parts of a saddle, how long a horse could ride in a day, the different parts of a wagon, believe it or not, there are an awful lot of them, and the different types of weapons that were used back then.
Right.
Because God help you if you get that wrong, especially in a Western, people will pop up and point it out to you, just like they will in your police procedural novels, your investigation novels. You know that better than anybody.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. But yeah, I mean, you do each really well. And in your Westerns, like Where the Bullets Fly, that's one of the ones I always recommend to folks when they're trying to break into a Western and want to read a new author in that genre. And you bring us right back into the 1880s and you feel like you're there. So
go ahead.
Oh, sorry, please.
Oh, I was just going to say it's at its heart. It's about people who are very much relatable to us, because even though the time setting is different, people don't really change. Their goals are the same. They want to have a good life. They want to live in safety. They want to have prosperity for their families and their children. They want their communities to be safe. And, you know, sure, maybe it was, and life was harder back then. So through research, I actually find compelling ways to relate their struggle without saying, this was the 1880s, it was tough. No, you have to show that. You have to show how more difficult life was and how life was relatable back then to all the things I just mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I mean, my experience with that was playing Oregon Trail and dying of dysentery halfway across the country. You know, that was it. So you helped a lot on that one. Yeah. So as we finish up here, I'm doing something I call three quick hits, and you take your main character. Let's use Abraham Golden, and I'll ask you three quick questions about him, and it's just kind of an off the cuff kind of thing. So sure. What's Abraham's favorite music?
Abraham's favorite music would be 1950s jazz. He'd like to be on the cutting edge of a new sound, and I think he would enjoy the improvisation based on all of the stuff he had to do in my novella.
Yeah, I think that fits. How about his favorite drink or cocktail?
His favorite drink would probably be black coffee, because it's like his truth, straight, no chaser. And no sugar or cream to melt it down. I'd say if he drank, I probably would be a good cheap whiskey, because he'd want that kind of hit without the without all the fancy stuff.
Love it. And finally, his greatest fear.
I think his greatest fear is injustice. It's about the truth not coming to light. And I've written him as a very honest character who has his own code. He's not golden. He's not the golden boy, like his name in the novella implies. But he definitely has a code that he believes in and risks everything to do. He did that in real life, and my protagonist does that in the novella. Yeah.
Well, folks, we've been talking with Terrence McCauley about his new book, Chicago 63. You'll really want to check it out. And I'm looking for, there it is. And I'm looking forward to Dallas 63 coming up soon. So that's outstanding.
Thank you. Yeah. It's going to be a trilogy. The first one is called Twilight Town, and it sets up everything that happens before, in the months before the assassination, right up to assassination day. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun to write. And I hope it'll be a lot of fun for the folks to read.
I think it will be. Terrence, thanks for spending some time with us today on Authors on the Air. Really appreciated you coming by.
You got it, pal. Thank you.
We'll see you again soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.